Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that brings our history out of the closet and onto the radio. Today we highlight an hour from our June 14th, 2009 Gay Day at KPFK broadcast, which brings film, cinema, songs, and memories all together in a time capsule broadcast set for reopening in 2059. We've invited actor and comedian Jason Stewart and KPFK senior producer Christine Blasdale to join me together in listening to archival clips, music, and all kinds of gay stuff. Let's get on with the show. Is that what that is?
Yes, I met them. I think I work with them in the 90s.
Oh, that's cool.
It's hard to remember everything. In the 90s, so the 2015, in the 59s, they're just, I guess they're going the 90s. That must be like when we think the 50s.
Or like the turn of the century, the ought-nots.
Yes.
Or something like that.
Yes.
Well, so Jason is an actor and comedian, and he's been in over 100 TV shows and films. He's best known for playing Dr. Thomas on My Wife and Kids and the film Coffee Date.
That's a series with Damon Wayans, who in the 2000s was a very popular heterosexual comedian.
It's kind of neat to think that people that we won't know are listening to us 50 years from now.
Yeah, it is. And my agent just texted me. So I text my agent back. So that's the things that we used to do through our cell phones in these days. I don't know. I'm sure they probably have a text. They can probably have a voice activated attached to their lip and then, you know, touch their ear, and there's a credit card thing on their finger. And
we should have a queer sci-fi person try to figure out what gay life in the future would be. That would be fun.
There will be no gay life. I mean, we'll all be one.
That is the idea.
I think so.
You know, we're also welcomed by Christine Blasdale, who's one of the co-hosts and co-producers of Gay Day at KPFK. Christine, we're here for Time Capsule. So we were talking about 2059 is when some of this, well, all of this will be listened to by somebody, I hope.
I think it's sort of exciting, yeah.
I hope so, too, with the way the world is right now and all the insane things going on. I hope there is a 2059.
I'm right now in a place called Cincinnati, Ohio. That's where I am today, which probably doesn't exist in 2059.
It's such a weird concept to think what would actually be here in 50 years. Will we go really far, or will it be just the same, a little bit better with...
We were talking before. You said you'll be here, you'll be almost 100, and I'll be 26. So
he's an ovum now.
Yes, I'll be young, and I'll be 6 feet under probably somewhere. Oh. I don't think I'll be here. I don't think I'll live that long. I'm not one to, you know, want to be, you know, have my head in a basket and go, hey, I'm fine.
You don't want to do the Disney thing?
No. I'll be dead. I just can't. If my hair doesn't turn out right, I can't get up in the morning. Oh, hair. And in 2008, I shaved my head for a movie that's out now called The Pit and the Pendulum. I did a remake of The Pit and the Pendulum last year where I played Father Duvet and I talk like this. So if somebody can get the DVD in 2059 or the download of the 2009 remake of the Vincent Price film, Edgar Allan Poe's The Pit and the Pendulum, I'm in the first scene. I play Father Duvet.
Here, I'm going to be a voice from 2059. What's a DVD? Hey, why don't we listen to our first clip?
Yes, let's do it.
It's a surprise.
Oh, I love that.
Arthur Blake started Betty Davis. No, what I mean is Arthur Blake started the caricature and the impersonation of Betty Davis. For many, many years, no one imitated me, and it frightened me to death. Because I think unless you attain a point where there's something so definite about you can imitate it, you must be a rather dull performer. And Arthur started with the swinging of the arms and the whole bit. No, no. The only other one I've seen many people do me. Well, it's a compliment. It has gotten to a point now, the way they do me, every now and then, I might get a little irked. But basically, it is a compliment. I truly think that way about it. What? Of the Earlier Years is my all-time love, Dark Victory. Because I loved the girl. Most of all, I loved the story. I loved what the director did with it. And really, when anyone asks you if you have a favorite film, it must have all the ingredients as a finished product. And as a matter of fact, I never ever went and saw myself till years later in any film I did, but I did want to see Victory, so they gave me a projection room all alone. And when I finished seeing it, I walked across the Warner lot, and I was so ashamed because I couldn't get a grin off my face. And I felt so immodest that I was so pleased with it. But I think script-wise, director-wise, I thought that Mr. Brent was just beautiful in it. And it's my all-time favorite of all those years.
What is your opinion of Joan Crawford?
Is this a gag question? You want me to say something vile about her? No, let me tell you something very interesting. There were never two more opposed actresses working together in the world. Just totally different people and systems. But I will say this for Miss Crawford. She is a professional. She is always on time. She knows her lines. And we made Jane, you know, in 3 weeks, Joan and I. 3 weeks. Because that is all the money anybody would give for us. Because whenever Mr. Aldrich went to anybody for backing for this, they say, those two old broads, never. It's true. It's absolutely true. And finally, he got enough money, and we met. 1 week rehearsal and 3 weeks shooting, we did Jane, and it wasn't easy. But I had great respect for her as a professional. That she is. And I wish I were half as beautiful. That I will say for her. Now, if you want to meet me privately sometime.
Jason Stewart.
You know what's really the most interesting thing is Betty Davis has what they call a mid-Atlantic accent, and that's what they use to train actors. She's from Connecticut. So she talks like this, darling, and everything is like that. And all of a sudden she's always in a movie, and she's always talking like this, and she's very grand. Not grand, grand. I always think a mid-Atlantic accent somewhere between London and New York, which is really the middle of the ocean, so bubbles should be coming out of her mouth. But that was really neat. And I guess this is one of those live interview shows that it was a talk with Betty Davis, which I guess in the 60s, that's sort of the reality television.
Well, you know what it was? It was 1969, the San Francisco Film Festival had a tribute to Betty Davis. So this was live on stage, and this is the only existing recording.
And what was really also neat about it is she said projection room. You know, never mind. What is it? A DVD? I think people might know what a DVD is because we know what records are. But a projection room, that's what they used to do, where they would actually use the actual film and they'd show it on a projector, which projected it onto the walls the way movies used to be seen, not through the computer. And that's what they would do for stars in those days. You'd have your own projection room in the studio and they'd all watch it and there'd be a phone and they'd say, Jimmy, play the film. And they'd hang up. And she talked about Joan Crawford. And what's really interesting about Joan Crawford was I think that all this stuff, she was smart enough to know that it was going to cause a lot of bitch diva talk all the time. And she was smart enough to know. And just the way she handled herself, it shows you the way people used to handle themselves in those days. She knew exactly how to answer that question. And it, to her, being a professional and showing up on time is really, really important. Whereas now, some people, you know, that is not the thing anymore. Because I've worked on tons and tons of independent films with people who are not even anywhere in the, you know, I guess, stratosphere of Betty Davis who don't show up on time.
So many people know me. I wish I did. I wish someone would tell me about me. Besides something spelled out in light bulbs, I mean. Besides something called a temperament.
which consists mostly of swooping about on a broomstick, screaming at the top of my voice. Infants behave the way I do, you know. They carry on and misbehave. They'd get drunk if they knew how. When they can't have what they want, when they feel unwanted or insecure or unloved. More than anything in this world, I love Bill, and I want Bill. I want him to want me, but me, not Margot Channing. And if I can't tell them apart, how can he?
Right. You know what I like about this, too, is that Bette Davis not only gets points for being a gay icon, but being her as an empowered woman in a man's world empowered women so much. The Women in Film Foundation
but
you got to think about this, though,
when the movie industry started, that's not really the history. The history is, at the turn of the century, Jews, gays, women, they were in power. They were empowered first before the straight guys came in and took over. So we had the power and we lost it. It wasn't the other way around. There were tons of women directors, tons of lesbians doing things. Everybody was out. But it was not out in the way that we're out now. It was a different out. The out in those days was, let's say they'd say, oh, Jason Stewart, you know him. He was a king of a country, and he came to this country, and he became a silent film star. They would make up all this kind of stuff about people all the time. So your background really had nothing to do with anything that was really truthful. And Barbara Streisand, if you know, as a joke, when she was on Broadway and I Can Get You Wholesale, she didn't want to say, oh, this is a girl from Brooklyn. That was her first Broadway show. So she was 19, I believe, when she did. She'd say, oh, Barbara Streisand, you know, was born in Bangladesh and she was reared in New Guinea and she's here making her debut on Broadway. And they finally made her stop because they said, you can't, you've got to tell the truth. But people used to do that. Publicity was made up. So in a sense, she was empowered, but women were empowered. The power was taken from them. You know, when the religious right came in, probably around the late 20s or early 30s, and all of a sudden they had these Catholic Christian groups telling us how we should make our monies, and the studios became a little more studio and less run by artists and all that kind of stuff. So it sort of hit, the history sort of changed. And I'm wondering in 2059, what's going on, you know? Whether we're back.
When I last night had a great big fight, everything seemed to go wrong. I looked up to my surprise, the gal I was with was gone. Where she went, I don't know. I mean to follow everywhere she goes. Folks said I'm crooked, I didn't know where she took it. I want the whole world to know. They say I do it, ain't nobody caught me. Sure got to prove it on me. When I was last night with a crowd of my friends, there must have been women, cause I don't like no men. It's true, I wear color and a tie, make the wind blow all the while. Cause the spell I do it, ain't nobody caught me. They sure got to prove it on me.
Hey, let's listen to another clip from our fabulous archives.
Hi, tell me your name.
Don Kilhefner.
And tell me about yourself. Give yourself a title.
A title. terrorist.
Quite a controversial title these days.
No, I've been involved in gay community activities here in Los Angeles since 1968. Helped to start the gay liberation movement, co-founder of the Gay and Lesbian Center, co-founder of Van Ness Recovery House with Harry Hay, co-founder of the Radical Fairies, an international movement of gay spirituality and gay consciousness, and do a lot of work around intergenerational work, intergenerational communication, cooperation, projects, etc.
So you were here in L.A. working when Stonewall happened in New York City.
You got it. Yeah, I was a doctoral student at UCLA.
How did you first hear about Stonewall, and what was its
impact? It was on the front page of the L.A. Times, saying this thing had happened in Greenwich Village, and there were police cars burning, and there were people throwing stones, and the police were afraid to enter. And I thought, oh, these are my people. Troublemakers.
You terrorists.
And I've been involved with it ever since.
Yeah. So immediately after Stonewall happened, what was the impact on the West Coast for you?
The impact here was immediately, I don't know if you heard the talk tonight. No. The first thing was organizing the Gay Liberation Front. Stonewall happened June 28, 1969. By September of 69, 2 months later, the Gay Liberation Front was organized here in Los Angeles by Morris Kite. I got involved in October. So it was just having an organization where militant, radical, revolutionary fags and dykes could come together and talk and plan and what have you. The second phase was 1970, where there was all kinds of activity going on trying to overthrow heterosexual supremacy. And then by 1971, the focus became creating a community where none had ever existed before. And that involved creating the Gay and Lesbian Center and other community organizations.
Yeah. How do you think that experience of creating the community where none was relates to what we're experiencing now in the wake of Prop 8, where we have a community and we have some kind of open political future here? What do you think?
Well, I think there's a larger question here is what happened with the Reagan Revolution when we had the pendulum swing to the extreme right, where such things as community building, such things as social justice, such things as providing services to people who knew them was eliminated. And the emphasis by the Reagan Revolution was put on making money, nuclear family, values that very rarely did they live by. And so what's happening, I think, with President Obama's election is the pendulum's beginning to swing again. Even if it swings to the center, that's good enough. I think young people are beginning to get activated again. And as you heard this evening, I think that's where Proposition 8 is important, because it activated young people. Where we have to be careful is many times when there's a demonstration or something, people will show up and then you don't see them again for a year or two. So it has to be rebuilding a community in a way that allows people to stay involved over a long period of time. And that's your generation, your generation's work.
So for you, the key component is the activism rather than the acts of a Supreme Court or some
Oh, yeah. It's more than just getting marriage rights. We're dealing here with heterosexual supremacy. Just like black people had to deal with white supremacy, black people and their white allies overthrew that. Just like women had to deal with male supremacy, women and their male allies dethroned male supremacy. Now we have to overthrow heterosexual supremacy. And that's just, we're just beginning that now. And the proposition of marriage is just one aspect of that. There's a much bigger picture here with heterosexual supremacy.
And that was a clip from the Stonewall teach-in just a few weeks ago. Our KPFK news guy, Dan, came and went and interviewed some folks that were at Stonewall.
Don Kilhefner, Morris Kite, Harry Hay, Robin Tyler. I mean, there's some people in the 70s who, Harvey Milk, you know.
I'm Harvey Milk. I'm a supervisor in San Francisco. And I'm gay.
And so am I.
I just, sometimes I think to myself.
We're here with Jason Stewart, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, an actor and comedian.
Just,
that wasn't really very funny, but let's let's talk about it anyway.
What?
The Stonewall clip.
No, it's not funny, but what was really touching to me, sometimes I think, my God, what was it like you know, to walk in these people's shoes. I mean, I knew that in the 70s, when I was a little gay kid, I was frightened. And I remember that TV show, Get Smart, and the way he kept walking through these doors, and these doors would slam shut. And that's the way it felt to me all the time. I'd see something, and I go, God, I don't want to be that. Slam shut. Like, I remember I saw a show. We had a TV show called PM Magazine. And it was a magazine show. They called it. It had short little things. There was this girl named Carney that was on the show. And she was a folk singer. And she was transgender. And they talked about, and I don't know what she said, or, you know, I just said, oh, my God, I'm just like this girl. And she had her penis cut off. And I thought, oh, my God, door slammed shut. I don't want my penis cut off. You know, then I remember I sold maps to Stars Homes when I was a kid in the eighth grade. And I saw these two drag queens fighting on the corner, beating the crap out of each other, who were prostitutes.
Door closed.
Door slammed shut. You know, I remember all this stuff that I saw that caused me not to want to be gay, that had nothing to do with loving my brothers, nothing to do with falling in love with some great man and spending my life. It had nothing to do with anything that was real to me. And I also felt, which was really interesting in the 70s growing up, sort of pushed into some sort of feminine thing in the way, which is really not who I am. I mean, certainly I have feminine qualities about me, but it's not my personal makeup. And not that it's bad, but I remember that was, if you're in love with, and I'll say some icons that you might not know. If you saw a movie called The Way We Were and you were in love with Robert Redford, who you were left to be but Barbara Streisand? And
right,
and you know, that's what would happen, is you'd have no identity. And these guys, those names that I just mentioned, they sort of helped us create a community from nowhere. And now in 2009, 50 years later, or 40 years later,
40 years later,
math is not my thing. I'm just pretty. and this is 90 years later, right?
Right.
Hopefully people can just be who they are and develop in a normal way, because I didn't.
Christine, he was talking about hetero supremacy. Did that?
You know, I love that word.
The first time I've ever heard that. How did that strike you?
Well, you know, growing up, I actually never thought there was a really choice, because I had never really seen, you know, I was never really that close to many, you know, lesbians that I knew of, except for I had a very strong relationship, my fifth or sixth grade teacher was, now looking back on it, of course, she was definitely gay. And she was just someone that I trusted and I felt safe with, that I could talk about, you know, just those growing pains that you have. I always thought that, like, growing up, that it was just, if you're a girl, you grow up, you have a handsome prince come and rescue you from your situation, and they'll take care of you and everything will be fine. But
me too. That's what I thought was going to happen to me.
But I couldn't, you know, like, when I came up to my dad, you know, he said, I kind of knew. He goes, when all the other little girls, you know, had they're playing with their Barbie dolls and stuff. And I did. I played with Barbie dolls too. But I also play with G.I. Joe and other things. But he said the Farrah Fawcett poster in your bedroom was my first kind of clue. He goes, because...
And my dad, the clue was that I didn't want the Farrah Fawcett picture.
And you know what's fascinating about all of that, and we're talking about the future, this whole idea that you identify with being male is something that probably will not exist anymore. And me identify with being female, because it's because you wanted the woman. So you figured if you want the woman, then you have to become the man, because we have no other.
Right.
Where's my spot?
Well, that's what this guy was talking about with hetero supremacy, is that much like African Americans dealt with white supremacy and gender, the women had to deal with male supremacy, that we as a gay community that have sort of evolved culturally and politically and empowered socially, that we actually have something to battle, which is a hetero supremacy of giving us or taking away our rights.
Well, especially like when I'm from the belief that we have so many, there's that Kinsey, you know, scale. We have so many different aspects to our sexually. And there have been many of my friends too who are like, you know, don't put me in, even in the gay community, don't lock me into this, that I am a lesbian or that I am straight.
Women are more like that though.
Because
I think.
If they are bisexual in particular, they're like, let me be me. I want to be me and not locked into this.
Women
this
are very much, I think, more connected to that to guys for two reasons. Number one, women are more fluid just the way they are emotionally, and also it's the actual mechanics of it. A woman can try things without having to perform, in a sense.
I believe that everyone in life should have a mission. Making people happy is the height of my ambition. And when I get them happy, well, they stay in that condition. I have a system all my own. I got a lot of what I got. And what I got's all mine. And I'll show you, I can show you if you're feeling blue. Come up and see me sometime. I got a flat where you can hang your hat. I got a brand new line. Maybe you would like me to explain it all to you. Come up and see me sometime. Come up tonight. I think the paper said the moon will be bright. They should have had it in the columns and all letters that tall that you'll be falling for me. 'Cause I'm free and you appeal to me. How could it be a crime if you don't get my number? Well, my number's in the book. Come up and see me sometime.
You are listening to From the Vault, the original weekly series produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives. For a copy of this program or to browse the other programs in this series, go to fromthevaultradio.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. You can also find out more information about how you can participate in the Gay Day Time Capsule Project.
Come up and see me sometime. Anytime. The sooner the better.
And now back to the roundtable. Hey, let's listen to another clip.
Oh my God. Who is it? Let's see.
It's a surprise.
Dun, dun, dun.
He was reluctantly born on Christmas Day in 1908. To his dismay, he found himself to be the son of middle-class, middle-brow, middling parents who lived in Sutton, a suburb of London, England. After an uneventful childhood, he was sent, between the ages of 14 and 18, to a school which was like a cross between a monastery and a prison. There he learned nothing that could be useful to him in adulthood except how to bear injustice. His ignorance of everything but this and his ambiguous appearance made any career impossible, except in the arts. And this describes the early life of Quentin Crisp, also known and perhaps best known as the Naked Civil Servant. I'm Jessica Schumann, and today Quentin Crisp is my guest. Welcome.
Thank you.
You perhaps best exemplify Shakespeare's tenet that the world is a stage and we but players. Your whole life in recent years is an acting out of who you are. Perhaps you talk about how you evolved who you are, how you evolved this style that you've become notorious for. And you've said that it's certainly not famous, it is definitely notorious, whether you dabbled in other lifestyles, whether you had other images which you donned and then threw off because they didn't suit you, like a hat that didn't quite fit your head.
Well, I did, of course, experiment to some extent, because everybody does. In the beginning, I was entirely unsure of myself, especially when I was at school. And when I was young, I alternately confirmed and denied my existence. But after a while, you can't keep that up. You have to make up your mind whether you're going to try and make yourself over to the world's opinion of what you should be like, or whether you're going to stay with what you find that you are. And what made the world cross was to find that I was so effeminate. What at school was merely thought to be feeble. I didn't want to play games, I didn't want to get hurt, and this annoyed everybody very much. And I would sometimes pretend that I was playing games and run round a field and try to get
dirty. And that was Quentin Crisp.
And
from
then on other days, I would think, no, this
by
is
Jessica
nonsense.
Schumann, long-winded
so
Jessica Schumann.
So I would lounge about saying, what is football?
A definite man
and so
who,
and
I
it
think
wasn't until I
became
left school and went out
a sort of
the world
one of our first transgender
I
people.
Must make up my
I mean,
mind. And then I decided
he certainly had
that
all the male
I
body parts
out all
and
the elements
totally
of
self-identified
my
as a woman. I
the
think,
moment comes
in his own
for
way because
when
he was
he
finding
has
a
to
place
do
to
deliberately
fit in.
What he and used to do
because
by mistake.
I think in those days,
and
you know,
I suppose
who was
I
he to be? He was
at
the
about
first.
Age 25.
Him and Oscar Wilde, you know. I guess in England is the two I can think of who were very flamboyant, very over the top. You know, they created the stereotype of what we call gay men in those days. And those were the ones we could see. Mm-hmm. So the ones that were hidden, you know, certainly didn't get the play that those two gentlemen did. And man, the bravery of them is just overwhelming to me. My heart is so full when I listen to them and I hear him speak, and I think, and interesting, his accent is also, I don't think his accent exists anymore. I think the English accent has changed, it's become much more mid-Atlantic, no. it's become much more Americanized, for the lack of a better description. He had a certain way of curling the back of his, I guess this is my actor.
We'll have to have Henry Higgins come in and tell us all about it. I think it's a part Welsh. In
oh,
part,
is that what it was?
I knew him. I should know this.
You know, I just, I think to myself,
but it's a mix
my
of something.
God, what did this guy have to go through? And now everybody is, I'm in Cincinnati headlining that Pride there, watching the people in the Midwest go crazy and do whatever they want to do. And you're in Hollywood now. And West Hollywood, and it's, I'm just thinking to myself, my God, you know, I'm just, I wish someone could call us from 2059 and tell us what's going on. I'm just so
well, maybe
this.
By then they could.
Yeah.
We never
maybe
know
they
the
have,
nature.
Maybe there's maybe time they travel. Maybe they are calling us right now, and we don't know.
All right, so speaking of time travel, we're going to travel back in time again to, I guess we're going to sort of identify it.
Can I just say one more thing about Quentin Crisp? Yeah. I believe there is a sequel to The Naked Civil Servant, which is the film, and it's going to be at the Outfest. And you guys should all go. And you guys should all go to Outfest.
Yeah, absolutely.
No matter how.
And John Hurt takes Quentin Crisp role up again that he did in The Naked Civil Servant back in
was
the
it
late
70s. A television film in London, England?
Right.
Yeah, because I'm dying to see that. I remember seeing The Naked Civil Servant and being blown away. Yeah.
That was the first thing that showed me personally that's who I was somehow. But again, I was scared of the purple hair. I was like, I don't want my hair purple.
Yeah, and I didn't want to have to be beat up and wear lipstick all the
time.
Right.
I don't want to do nails.
Can I say one thing before we go to the next clip?
Yeah.
There was a movie in 1971 called That Certain Summer. It starred Hal Holbrook, who is a wonderful actor who was Oscar nominated for the film Into the Wild. Martin Sheen, very hot and sexy, who was the president on a show in the 90s,
West Wing.
In the 2000s called West Wing. And Hope Lang, who people don't know, from very big star in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, Oscar nominated and was on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
In the Ghost of Mrs. Muir TV
Muir,
series.
With the gay icon Charles Nelson Reilly. And in the preview for the show that they show on television, which they used to show on TV shows, she kept screaming, saying, if he were a woman, I'd know how to compete! And I remember seeing this movie, and I watched it on a little TV show, television set in the day, when I was a kid, the smaller the TV set, the cooler it was. And I had this little TV set. We didn't have remote controls then. And that's a little plastic thing that you would turn on TV on and off with. And I remember there was a scene where Hal Holbrook was helping his lover, and that's what we called him in those days, pack his stuff up because his son was coming to visit that certain summer so he could tell him he was gay. And Martin Sheen put his hands on Hal Holbrook and said everything's going to be okay. And I remember, oh my God, those are two guys wearing guys' clothes who look like people that I know, wearing sweaters, touching each other. And the door just sort of opened a little for me. And I remember seeing that and thinking, I I better start wearing sweaters.
When the earth was still flat, and clouds made of fire, and mountains stretched up to the sky, sometimes higher. Folks roamed the earth like big rolling kegs. They had two sets of arms, they had two sets of legs, they had two faces peering out of one giant head, so they could watch all around them as they talked while they read. And they never knew nothing of love, it was before all the origin of love.
All right, so our next clip is pretty bloody incredible. Actually, let's just hear it, and then we'll come back in and tell you what it's all about.
Recipe for hashish fudge was given me by Brian Geisen, which anyone could whip up on a rainy day. This is the food of paradise. It might provide an entertaining refreshment for a ladies' bridge club or a chapter meeting of the DAR. Take 1 teaspoon black peppercorn, 1 whole nutmeg, 4 average sticks of cinnamon, 1 teapot coriander. These should all be pulverized in a mortar. About a handful each of stoned dates, dried figs, shelled almonds, and peanuts. Chop these and mix them together. A bunch of cannabis sativa can be pulverized. This, along with the spices, should be dusted over the mixed fruit and nuts, kneaded together. About 1 cup of sugar dissolved in a big pat of butter, rolled into a cake and cut into pieces or made into balls about the size of a walnut. It should be eaten with care. 2 pieces are quite sufficient. Obtaining the cannabis may present certain difficulties, but the variety known as Cannabis sativa grows as a common weed, often unrecognized, everywhere in Europe, Asia, and parts of Africa, besides being cultivated as a crop in the manufacture of rope. In the Americas, while often discouraged, its cousin called Cannabis indica has been observed even in city window boxes. It should be picked and dried as soon as it has gone to seed while the plant is still green. The recipe was innocently included without my realizing that the hashish was the accented part of the recipe. And that I was shocked.
All right, take the little piece of matzo meal and put it into a bowl and stir it up. You'll get a latke. And you'll turn it around and drop a little heroin on the side. Every time I take it, I feel like I own a country in a small village called Stanislaus. And Gertrude, get off me.
Well, this was an offense to the American eye and the American thought, because they were afraid they were up against the law. And so my publisher wired to Washington and asked the administration if it were possible to use such a recipe. When it appeared, there'd been an outcry. The magazines took it up. And he got as an answer from Washington, "You may do anything you please except eat it. That is forbidden by law. You may grow it, you may manufacture it, but you may not sell it, and you may not eat it." Brian Geisen himself wired me and said, "What are we doing about this?" And I said, "I'm doing nothing. What can you do?" I was shocked to find that it was hashish. I thought it was just a joke of his. And he said, well, something should be done. And so he wired to the editor, who paid no attention to him. He said it was too late, later in conversation. So that was that. It never went into the American edition. The English are braver. We're not courageous about that sort of thing.
I love her. It's just hysterical.
Wait, is hashi an ink?
That's apparently a recipe to make pot brownies. It takes around two, can I say the F word?
I don't think we can.
Two friggin', you know, hours to do it. Dear God, it took them forever to get high in those days.
Forever. All right, so I guess we should let it out that that's Alice B. Toklas. I'm reading from her autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, and she was the lover of Gertrude Stein, and it's been depicted in films by Linda Hunt. She's probably one of the ugliest women in history.
Who?
Alice B. Toklas.
Was she?
Yeah. Yeah, she really was one of the ugliest women in history.
So there's hope for everyone.
There is hope for everyone that they could
find. And, of course,
love.
Pat Carroll did the Gertrude Stein, one-person show.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
And they hung out with Pablo Picasso and clearly were of the bohemian age in the 20s when they lived
it
in Paris together.
It always sounds so exciting, that era. You know,
I know,
it sounds so wonderful. And then I think to myself, God, it must have been awful. Because this fear, this constant living with fear.
Masculine women, feminine men, which is a rooster, which is a hen? It's hard to tell them apart today and say, sister is busy learning to shave, brother just now the permanent wave. It's hard to tell them apart today. Hey, hey, girls were girls and boys were boys when I was a child. Now we don't know who's who, even what's what. Knickers and trousers, baggy and white, nobody knows who's walking inside. Those masculine women and feminine men.
I mean, I know that I wrestle with self-esteem in certain areas and in my work as an actor and as a comedian. And I, around a couple years ago, I started the Screen Actors Guild LGBT Committee, which I'm the national chair for. And talking to people in the motion picture industry about the idea of us playing different roles and being who we are and appearing to be who we are is sort of still foreign in 2009. You know, 20 years ago, black women became judges in almost every TV show that there is. I mean, when I was a kid, if you saw a black woman as a judge, it would be that special episode, you know. But now it's become this commonplace thing. And honestly, the reason it's become commonplace is because they are told by the unions that they want to use people of color in different roles, but they never want to give us the leads.
So the judge is good.
So the judge is good because you're off to the side. And I say thank God for it because then people get to make a living. But, you know, hopefully in 2059, you know, things have changed and all types of people can play all types of roles. And we can also see our stories. And we also will be allowed to play the roles of our stories.
That's such a big part, too, of Hollywood. As you know, there's so many actors and actresses who are still in the closet, have been in the closet for maybe for fear of financial ruin or they're not going to get the jobs.
It's not maybe. It is a fear. It's a real fear.
Yeah. And there's a very few, though, that have come out, but it's so small in number that...
Well, compared to the amount that are in the industry, probably. I mean, they're... You know, for some reason, gay people, and as our first clip, you know, Betty Davis, you know, sort of gave us the feeling that when you see her in All About Eve, the boldness, the sense of humor, the style, we just seem to love all that. You know, so a lot of us, through those movies, everything from, you know, with all these wonderful women icons that we sort of identify with. I mean, did lesbians identify with men and want to be John Wayne or Robert Redford or Warren Beatty?
I wanted to be John Travolta a little bit.
And did you?
Saturday Night Fever, Grease.
Well, everybody did.
But I was torn because I was like in love with Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta at the same time. So I was really messed up.
No, you were just real. That was real.
Yeah, that's odd. I can't remember which one I wanted. I think I wanted to be Frenchie in Grease. I don't know why.
Ooh. Oh, really?
Because she got sung to by the beauty queen.
Frankie Avalon. Frankie
I remember Avalon. When I saw Marlon Brando on TV in Streetcar Named Desire, and I thought, man, that's what I want to be. That's hot. You know, and he was just so, and I saw it on television because I wasn't old enough. This is a film that's probably over 100 years old for these people here. Mm-hmm. And it was, Marlon Brando was a man who changed acting, literally, on film.
And there was actually somebody who helped him change acting on film because he hired him in his play, Streetcar Named Desire. And we're going to hear that person right now.
Really?
Mr. Williams, in your memoirs, you talk about, you describe your meeting with Mr. Brando. I wonder if you could recollect that for us.
Oh, I described them exactly as they were. If you read the memoirs, that's exactly how it took place. He was sent up by Edie Kazan, found him, you know. I hadn't heard of him even, and he was sent up to, I was spending some time on the Cape, and he sent him up there. And, he arrived several days after I was expecting him. And I had given up on him ever appearing. But he did finally arrive with this very pretty young chick. And we were living in desperate circumstances. Texas producer-director Margot Jones was there. And a colleague of hers, Joanna Albus, and all our lights had gone out, and the plumbing had broken down. And that's all described memoirs, but he repaired everything, and then he just sat down quietly and read. And after a few moments, Margot let out this whoop of delight and got on the phone and said, "This man is the greatest actor I've ever heard, even in Texas."
And we're back. And that was Tennessee Williams speaking of the first time that he met Marlon Brando. And what's really interesting, I was just saying to Christine, I don't think Marlon Brando would have had the opportunity if he wasn't so beautiful. He was just
no, he was striking.
Gorgeous.
Drop dead gorgeous.
And a brilliant actor and such a risk taker. And apparently through a lot of people, I mean, I don't know whether he was bisexual, but he had bisexual, and he spoke of it in different books. And I think he did partake, and I think it was more so that he was bohemian and sort of, you know, trying to ruffle people's feathers. And his roommate was Wally Cox, who was known to be homosexual, who was a television actor in the 50s and 60s, and a comedian, and people would know him from being on Hollywood Squares in the 60s and 70s as a television icon. And I think that Marlon probably was always interested in stuff and just interested in risking and sort of,
pushing the envelope a
pushing the
bit.
Button, yeah. Envelope, yeah. Pushing the button, pushing and pushing. I wish I was there so he could have pushed me. Man.
Yeah, he's gorgeous.
Indeed. So, that was Tennessee Williams. We've got them all here in our Pacifica Radio archives, a little history bit.
Doesn't my body drive you wild with desire? Well, doesn't it?
It's a very nice book.
Oh, do you really think so, darling? It does have a certain kind of style. I mean, look, it's very flat here. Not much hips. And, here.
It's a little early in the day for this sort of thing, isn't it?
Maybe you just don't sleep with girls. Oh. You don't. Well, listen. We're practically living together. So if you only like boys, I mean, I wouldn't dream of pestering you. Well, do you sleep with girls or don't you?
Sally, you don't ask questions like that.
I do.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Oh, God. I saw that movie with my dad. My dad was in the Holocaust, so he took me to any movie that had to do with Nazis. And I'm sitting there at the ABC Century Theater. Do you remember that theater?
Uh-huh.
In Century City. It doesn't exist anymore. and seeing this film, and she says he likes, and I was like, you would have thought I was a horse with blinders on. I was so afraid to, and then there's this one scene where Liza Minnelli, Fritz Weaver, and Michael York are all dancing in a circle together, and she says, how do I say this without saying the word? But she says, I want to F him. She says, I F'd him. And he says, oh, so did I. And I just about dropped dead. I didn't want to look at my dad because if he looked at me, he could tell I was gay, because it was written on my face, of course. And I was just
the smile,
it wasn't a smile. It was like, oh my God. There are people out there like me, because for me, and this is people probably in 2059 don't get this, but for me, all of my homosexuality was in my head. I never talked about it until I was in my early 20s to anybody. And so for me, it was so exciting and titillating and just reaffirming to know that there was people like me out there somewhere,
You didn't feel so all alone and odd. That's the importance of seeing, gay and lesbian characters in film and television. It's so, so important, because then you have a connection in for those people. I mean, we're lucky we live in Southern California, somewhat acceptable, but for those folks that live in Kansas or...
Except we can't, for those of you in 2059, there was a proposition here in 2008 that decided that we were not allowed to be married here. And I always say, come on, straight people. If you let us marry each other, we'll stop marrying you. And so it still is like that now. So there's these mixed messages. I mean, last year, a young boy was shot in the head in a school in an hour out of Los Angeles. I mean, shot in the head for liking another boy.
That's right.
I mean, so we've had some terrible, terrible things. And there's more stories like that that we don't know about.
Last week, I was traveling around Los Angeles with a television crew. The BBC is doing a sort of morbid retrospective of my Hollywood life over the years. And so we were visiting the scenes of my various crimes against what Italians call the 10th muse, and we call the movies. As I had written a number of pictures for MGM in the 1930s, I said, let's go over to the Thalberg building, where I had my office. Phone calls were made to the new owners, something called Sony Pictures Entertainment, an optimistic trade name if ever there was one. Not self-fulfilling, as it has so far proven, but... No, we could not go onto the lot, we were told. Why not? Well, Sony is trying to emphasize its corporate image, and so no former employee of MGM could come onto the lot, even though 40 years had passed. When it was pointed out that much of Sony's product is being made by former MGM employees, they said, well, they can work here, but they can't talk about MGM because we are promoting only Sony. Anyway, we circle the studio lot a number of times in a van, cameras rolling, I chatting away. Then we parked on a side street opposite the studio. A Culver City policeman suddenly appeared. You can't shoot here, he said. This is private property. The director said, but this is a public street. The cop said, no, this is private property. I said that the street was clearly marked as the property of Culver City. He repeated that it was private property, and so we moved on. I tell this story not to bash a Japanese corporation, particularly one that has my fullest sympathy, because by the time Hollywood's accountants are through with them, they will be in full retreat toward the setting sun. I mention this story to show that in the United States, everything, in effect, is the property of great corporations who pay little or no tax to the federal government, much less to state and municipalities where they do business. The only surprising aspect of this story is that we were told to move on not by a security guard of Sony, but by the Culver City Police Department, openly working for a private corporation at the expense of its own public. What we have, in effect, is a society where the taxes of the people at large support the few, the wealthy few. In other words, we have socialism for the rich and free enterprise for the poor.
Well, I want to hear a happy story, and I want you to tell me about your mom.
Oh, my mom?
Yeah, and we're sort of ending up we got about 5 minutes left, and we're going to hear about your mom, and then we're going to have some music and say goodbye.
My mother lives in Palm Springs, where all the Jews go to die. And I guess one day, you know, what's going to be interesting is somebody is going to be listening to this in 2059 and saying, there was that gay actor, comedian, Jason Stewart. Did you ever hear of him? No, I think his whole career fell apart. nobody gave a crap about him. And he'd talk about his mother all the time. My mother would, get really mad at me, and my brother would fight or act up. She'd say, if you don't stop this crap, I'm sending you all to military school. And I'd say, fabulous. Get your keys, get your purse. Come on, let's go. I hear they shave people. She was just so crazy growing up. She'd always say, my mother loves medication, any kind, especially prescription from the doctor. And she's in love with the pharmacist in Palm Springs. I'm serious. He's married, but she doesn't care. And so she always wears her little push-up bra and her boobs go, I'm wearing a push-up bra. I wonder how we got up here. And she goes in and she'll get some extra. I go to her house. She'll say, oh, here, take a diet pill. I broke it in half. Take one. You'll lose 10 pounds. I was 12. Even the other day, I said, I'm having trouble sleeping. She says, take this. And I took it. I went to an audition with a casting director. Thank God that I knew. And he said, Jason, your choices were so bizarre. You seemed like you were like, to play the character like you were high was very interesting, but certainly not right for the part. I was like so completely high for days because my mother was medicating me and drugging me. That's what she was doing.
I love that, radio is not visual, but I love the visual when you talk about your mom taking you to the beach.
Oh, high heels on the beach. I can't do that. But when I was a kid, my mother would wear complete makeup, complete joy, complete hair, and a leopard bathing suit.
That's my mom.
Yeah, that's why I'm gay.
That's why I'm gay.
Yes.
We have the same mother.
Then she wore these high heels, so when she walked on the beach in her high heels in the 70s in the sand, she'd walk with her high heels, falling into the sand. It was so fun.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we'd like to thank you for joining us, Jason Stewart.
Thank
comedian
you.
And actor, and we wish you all the best of breaking a leg in all of your business.
Yes, and if anybody wants to visit me, come to jasonstewart.com, Stuart, and my TV special From Here TV is on there, and they can get that, and support me so in 2059 people will know who the hell I am.
And that does it for this week's edition of From the Vault. Thanks to Steve Pride for the film clip and sound design he did for our Gay Day broadcast. The series is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. We're now streaming and podcasting online at fromthevaultradio.org. Thanks to all of our Pacifica listeners who joined our campus campaign and sponsored over 700 schools with the From the Vault series. For more information, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. Our music today was Masculine Women, Feminine Men by Merritt Bruni's and Friars Inn Orchestra, Come Up and See Me Sometime by Mae West, Prove It On Me Blues, Ma Rainey, The Origin of Love, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, Small Town Boy, Bronski Beat, Good Boys, Blondie, and Betty Davis as Margot Channing. And our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening, and if you're gay, come on out!